Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Everyone deserves to be safe. The LAVE Initiative provides mental health support to those impacted by intimate partner violence, also known as domestic violence. We take a holistic approach to help survivors of any age find ways to heal and thrive. Our virtual and in-person services include crisis and individual counseling sessions, support groups, psychotherapy, community-sensitive emergency housing, and linkages to a variety of community resources. The LAVE Initiative is brought to the community by the Jewish Board in partnership with UJA Federation. For more information, contact us confidentially at lave@jbfcs.org. That's lev@jbfcs.org or 646-273-1800.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I am a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member. And today I'm really, really honored and really, really excited to be here today with Dr. Ralph Strauss. Please, if you have a topic you want to hear, you want to be interviewed, you know someone who you want to hear being interviewed, you have comments in any of the podcasts, you have ideas on how to make it better, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. Dr. Strauss is a colleague of mine and part of Allied Pediatrics. And I heard him speak and said, oh, he has to be a guest of mine. And he was very gracious and agreed to. So I'm very excited to have him here today. Dr. Strauss is a practicing allergist for over 30 years. He is certified by the American Board of Allergy and Immunology. After graduating cum laude from Brandeis University, he began his medical career at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, where he received his medical degree in 1986. He did his internship and residency in pediatrics at Schneider Children's Hospital, Long Island Jewish Medical Center. There, he was recognized with the Best Resident Teaching Award in 1989. He followed up his residency with a two-year fellowship in allergy and immunology at the Long Island Jewish Medical Center. Dr. Strauss has multiple professional affiliations, including Winthrop University Hospital, North Shore University Hospital, South Nassau Communities Hospital, Long Island Jewish Hospital, and Stony Brook University Hospital, where he is a clinical assistant professor of pediatrics. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Nassau County Medical Society, and the American College and the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. He has authored and co-authored a number of publications for professional journals. He has made several TV appearances as an expert in allergy and has been quoted in media publications such as the New York Times. Also, I apologize, but we had some technical difficulties. And if you're watching this on YouTube, I apologize that we had to stop using video. Welcome, Dr. Strauss. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you.
Oh, no, I'm really excited. I told you, I heard you speak to our practices. And again, full disclosure, we are both part of Allied Pediatrics, which is a supergroup of pediatric practices, including yours, which is a subspecialty of allergy and asthma. So we refer to you a lot, and we really appreciate how well you take care of our patients. So thank you.
It's a mutual admiration and collaboration.
It's awesome. It's really awesome. So I told you also that I already interviewed both an allergist, which was Dr. Tehila Saadia, and that was called All About Allergies. And we spoke for a very long time. And then we looked up and said, we left out so much. We have to come back to the topics we left out, that we really focused primarily on food allergies. And then I spoke with a pulmonologist, Dr. Daniel Critch, who we talked about asthma, but really asthma in the younger children. So that was called All That Wheezes Is Not Asthma. So we're not going to talk about those things. We're not going to overlap too much, but we didn't talk about things like hives. So if we could start with talking about hives, also known as urticaria, it's a really common problem in pediatrics.
It sure is, and in adult medicine as well. Mm-hmm. So hives are these itchy bumps on the skin that are common. About 10% of the population will experience it at some time. They come in different shapes and sizes. They come and go. For diagnostic purposes, one of the important things to know is that if you drew a circle around one of the lesions, it wouldn't be there in 24 hours. So if it scars or leaves a bruise, provided you haven't scratched it excessively, you may be dealing with something that is not hives, but they can be a real nuisance.
Right. How do you distinguish them from some other rashes? The reason I'm saying this is because I do have parents coming in saying their child has hives, and when I see a picture of the rash, it isn't.
Right, exactly. So you have to look at You have to ask the questions. Does it itch? Does it come and go? How does it respond to treatment? Those are important things. And it really takes a decent diagnostic eye sometimes.
Right. And if you're not sure, take a picture of it because it can be transient. It's really Absolutely. Helpful when people bring pictures in because they'll go, I don't know, my kid had a rash last night and now it's gone. Picture, take a picture.
Absolutely. So important.
Yeah. And I also say it usually looks kind of like a mosquito bite because these flatter rashes, what we call maculopapular, which is really a ridiculous thing to say. It's really like, it's a rash and it's not hives.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we can't use descriptive terms, but yeah, they can be small little bite, insect bite looking yeah. things. They can be very, very large coalescing, large target cell type lesions as well.
Right. What do you mean by target cell for the non-doctor? Well,
like a bullseye.
Okay. And by the way, when you say bullseye, I've seen it confused with Lyme disease rash.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For those kids, I when they come with just one of these circular rashes with it starting to fade in the center, and we're not sure whether it's a bug bite, sometimes I will give Benadryl and see if that makes a difference. And if it goes down, that can be helpful, that it's more of an allergic hive. Not necessarily allergic, but a hive-like rash as opposed to that Lyme rash, because that could really be confusing.
Right. I'll tell you, Benadryl's not my favorite antihistamine. Mm-hmm. It's the standard, but if you were to put it on the market today, you'd say by comparison, it's shorter acting and it has a lot more side effects than some of the newer antihistamines. So I personally like cetirizine, which is Zyrtec, a whole lot. Mm. It works just about as fast as Benadryl, lasts a whole lot longer, and it doesn't make people cranky or really sleepy.
Yeah, and for little kids, it can make them paradoxically hyper.
Benadryl can, yes.
Yeah, why are we stuck on Benadryl? I feel like we're always told to use that in case of allergies. You can use Zyrtec with any kind of allergic reaction?
I do. Even for anaphylactic type of reactions, you know, Benadryl is the standard, but a lot of times I'll use cetirizine or Zyrtec as well. The newer, longer acting antihistamines like fexofenadine, which is Allegra, or loratadine, which is Claritin, some of their metabolites like Zizol or Clarinex are very acceptable as well. But I really like to steer people away from Benadryl.
That's really, really helpful to know. But again, we're not here for medical advice. Please talk to your healthcare professional. I always have to add that in there as a disclaimer. This is not, I listened to a YouTube video and I decided I'm not going to use Benadryl anymore. But you're right. You're right. I am hearing this about Benadryl, about all the adverse effects. You know, we think of it as so benign, just give some Benadryl.
And this is my personal practice. Other doctors may do things that are different.
Right, right. No, there's definitely room for us to be different in this. So what do we expect the course of hives to be?
They're very variable. There's acute, which is defined as less than 6 weeks in duration, and there's chronic. Some people will develop hives for months or years.
So what are common causes of urticaria or hives?
So we know that hives are associated with allergies. So if you look back and say, okay, I was just stung by an insect, or I just had an unusual food to eat, or I just took a new medication, that would be something you would highly suspect is the cause of the hives. But, you know, hives can occur at random for reasons we don't know, called idiopathic. And there is an association with viral illnesses that can trigger the immune system to cause histamine release and production of hives. So one of the things you have to do is do a careful history, look for possible causes, and then see if it makes any sense.
Right. And I'm going to skip a little bit ahead on my list here, but what we see a lot are these hive-like rashes in younger kids who are sick with some kind of viral illness. And it gets confusing when they've already been diagnosed with, say, an ear infection and put on an antibiotic and get hives. How do you tell the difference?
That's a great question. So one of the best practices in medicine is trying to unlabel people who might have been allergic to drugs like penicillin. I see a lot of adults who have avoided penicillin their entire lives because of some vague rash that they had in childhood. So there's penicillin allergy that's dramatic and life-threatening. Obviously, if you take a dose of an antibiotic and immediately develop throat closing, difficulty breathing, vomiting, breakout in hives, that is an anaphylactic reaction, and that drug should be avoided until you are properly tested to prove that maybe you're not allergic. But if a week or 10 days down the line, you've developed some vague rash that might be either itchy or not itchy, the chances are awfully good that you will be able to tolerate penicillin in the future. That's for one of two reasons. You may not have been allergic to penicillin in the first place. It may have been the initial infection that precipitated the rash. Or even if you were truly allergic, that allergic reaction may disappear over time, and it'll be safe for you to try penicillin antibiotics again in the future. I think that's really important because penicillin class antibiotics like amoxicillin and Augmentin are frequently the best antibiotics for treating common infections. They have less side effects, they're much more effective, and it's really good practice of medicine to try to get rid of a penicillin allergy if you can.
Get rid of the label of a penicillin allergy, right? I mean, we're not talking about desensitizing someone. Either they have a true allergy and they can't take it, or they don't.
Exactly.
Right. So how do you know whether they do or not? Is there testing for this?
It's number one, you go by the history. So if it's a vague history or a nonspecific rash that has occurred a week to 10 days later, there are a couple of different protocols that have been used. The standard one is to do an allergy skin test for penicillin and a couple of derivatives. And if those are negative, you follow that up with an oral challenge where you have the patient take a dose of the antibiotic in the office. You observe them for a period of time, usually 60 to 90 minutes. And then you can say, look, you're not going to have a severe reaction to penicillin. We cannot rule out delayed reactions to the antibiotic, which can occur with any antibiotic, but you're safe to take it. The next step in that protocol as we evolve in medicine is people have said, you know what, the skin tests for penicillin are usually not that predictive. And most people with a history of, benign rash are not at high risk. So why not go right to the challenge portion?
How accurate are those skin tests?
Again, the predictive value is probably about 60 to 70%. If it's positive, the chances are good you're going to react to penicillin. If it's negative, however, there's still a possibility you may break out when you take the antibiotic. And that's why the challenge portion is so important.
Mm-hmm. But it's not better to just do the test first because you'd be picking up 60 to 70%. It's not like you're having a high false positive. You're having a higher false negative, right?
It depends on the history. So if there's a history of anaphylaxis, you definitely should do the test first. If it's a history of a rash that's occurred a week to 10 days down the line, in the overwhelming majority, we're talking more than 90% of cases, the skin test is going to be negative. So we would, in many cases, just proceed to offering the patient, just let's take a dose of the antibiotic and see how you do.
Right. And again, I'm going to give my medical warning here. Talk to your doctor. Don't try this at home.
Absolutely.
But what you're saying is that there are cases where there's so many cases where we label children as being allergic to a penicillin drug just because they had a rash.
Right.
And it's really not likely that it's a true allergy and people get scared.
Right. And again, people, have to put the risks in perspective. So if you haven't had a severe reaction and it's just a vague type of rash, the chances of going into a really bad reaction are probably no greater than somebody who's taking the antibiotic for the first time or any other antibiotic. So you're just, going around and using other antibiotics that may have more side effects without that necessarily being the case.
Wait, I'm going to put a plug for not using antibiotics unless you really need to.
Absolutely.
I mean, I see that all the time with kids who really have a viral illness and, for whatever reason, they're put on an antibiotic and then they get a rash, which, as we said before, you can get hives with the virus.
Right.
Could be completely unrelated to the antibiotic and then they get labeled allergic.
Right. And, a lot of times, parents come in with a sick child and they want the doctor to do something.
Right.
And sometimes the best thing to do is just reassure them and say, look, this is likely to get better on its own. You don't need any medicine.
It's a hard sell sometimes.
It is, but giving medicine is not always benign, as we know.
Right. And that's why I pointed it out. Yeah. So also, what about a later reaction? How do you know that if you've given this in the office and you've waited, an hour and a half, that they're not going to have a reaction at 2 hours or 3 hours or 3 days?
Well, the really bad reactions happen really quickly.
Okay.
So anaphylaxis is likely to happen very soon. And again, it's a low risk challenge, but that's the reason we're doing it in the office, because you're equipped to treat allergic reactions with epinephrine if you need to. But again, it's a very relatively low risk challenge in terms of things that we do in our office. You cannot rule out delayed reactions, and that can happen with any drug, with any antibiotic.
Right. What about the reactions where they get swelling of the joints, fever?
Different story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are not truly allergic in the way that we in medicine would use that term, because it's not mediated through IgE antibodies. They happen through other inflammatory mechanisms, and those can be quite serious. So if you have, you know, joint pain or mucous membrane involvement, that's a different story, and that drug should be avoided.
Right. And there's no challenge for that kind of patient.
Nope.
Right. Let's be really careful with that. So let's go back. We were talking about hives in general. Are there specific tests you would recommend?
The best test is a good history. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like doing detective work. It's there's a lot of areas in medicine where you throw out a whole lot of tests and you see what comes up positive, and that's the wrong thing to do.
Right.
So you really don't want to do any unnecessary testing. Because I'm really fond of saying that an allergy test is not like a pregnancy test where you get a positive or a negative and you know for sure what's going to happen. Allergy testing is difficult to interpret, and you can get what's called false positive tests. So if you throw out a test for 100 different foods, 10 of them are going to come back positive and they're not going to make any sense at all. So if the hives have been present for more than a day or two, it's not a food allergy. If you think about, you know, your friend's kids with really severe food allergies, they have peanuts, they break out in hives, they get really sick, it's gone the next day. So if your kid or yourself has been breaking out in hives for days, it's almost certainly not a food allergy reaction. And then you have to look at, okay, was there a new medication involved? Was there a recent illness? And very often you don't have to do any testing.
Right, right. That's also can be a hard sell, but it's important to explain that clearly. I had multiple patients who've been labeled as having so many allergies. And I remember one of them had so many, it didn't fit into the box in the electrical records. And eventually the kid just started eating everything. It was okay with pretty much all of it. So whoever did that testing did not do that child a favor.
Nope,
so,
not
yes,
at all.
Don't do scattershot allergy testing, please. And again, we talked about there being so many other causes of it, and taking history, making that association, you know, doing that detective work is the most helpful piece. So let's talk about treatments. What medication do you use for hives?
I use the relatively non-sedating antihistamines. Mm-hmm. So I would use cetirizine, which is Zyrtec, or fexofenadine, which is Allegra. And I like to use the generic names because the generics are cheaper.
Right.
You don't have to buy the brand. They come in liquid, they come in tablets, and then we dial up the dose until the patient is comfortable. So there, you know, when you buy the box, you're going to see a standard dose for treatment of allergic rhinitis, you know, 5 milligrams for a child, let's say 10 milligrams for an adult. And if you're really uncomfortable and you're breaking out in severe hives, you can go up on that dose. We have guidelines that indicate that up to 4 times the recommended dose is okay to use. So for an adult, for instance, you could take 4 pills of Allegra or Zyrtec, or for a child, you could double the standard dose if that's making them comfortable. Again, you need to have a doctor's guidance
Right. We can't say that enough. Every time you start talking about treatment, yeah, this is not to be done at home. And some pediatricians will refer to allergists and some will do it on their own.
Right.
Right. It really depends. And if you're not comfortable, get a second opinion. So back to the treatments, you didn't mention Benadryl. I thought that's the antihistamine we know the best. Why not?
I'm not a big fan of Benadryl. It's, you know, it's been the standard. It's been around for the longest amount of time. It's a very effective antihistamine, but when you compare it to the newer antihistamines, it's shorter acting and has a lot more side effects. It makes most people sleepy or cranky or impair their ability to function. You can't.
Or paradoxically hyper. Yeah, paradoxically hyper in younger kids.
Right.
For some reason.
So I know Benadryl is the standard and a lot of doctors use it, but I don't recommend it routinely.
Right. And this is why I don't recommend it when parents say, we're going on a flight. We're going on a long flight. What about Benadryl to make my child sleep?
It may have the opposite effect.
Exactly. Exactly. And why would you give a medication to your child that can have adverse effects?
Right.
Right. Unnecessarily. So let's go over how long we would expect this to last. Because I think that's something that's really important to explain, that they can come and go for a while.
Yeah, it's very variable. So acute hives are defined as less than 6 weeks. So if you have a viral illness or something like that, you would expect it to last maybe a few days, maybe up to a couple of weeks. If it's lasting longer than that, or if it's really uncomfortable for you, you should definitely see a doctor.
Right. What about steroids?
Steroids work. The side effect profile is not necessarily favorable. Again, we use it all the time for things like asthma or really severe reactions, but it's not a good long-term treatment. So it's going to be effective. And then the hives will often come back as soon as you stop the medication. So that's not a great way to go. We use it short-term if we need to, if somebody's really very uncomfortable. But it's not really a standard treatment for hives.
Right. What about for allergic reactions?
It depends on the reaction. Mm-hmm. So for instance, in our anaphylaxis guidelines, steroids have really not been shown to be effective.
Interesting.
By convention, you'll usually get it if you wind up in the emergency room. And a lot of emergency room and urgent care doctors will prescribe a longer course, like 3 to 5 days. But there's no evidence that shows that that's any more effective than a single dose or even using it at all.
Right. I mean, medicine changes, and we're not, you know, coming out here to show lack of respect to other people's way of practicing. It's not really a clear cut right or wrong here. But I think it's important to get out the latest information.
Right. Well, you know, there is some evidence to support that, and the guidelines no longer recommend steroids for the treatment of anaphylaxis. It's an option, but really not recommended.
Right. It's not contraindicated. We're moving away from it. But when we say moving away from it, other people are still, you know, other professional healthcare professionals are still using it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's not that they're wrong, but it's good to know this.
As you point out, we're in an evolving spectrum of medicine and science, and we're learning more as we go along. But it's important to keep an open mind and realize that there are a lot of gray areas.
Absolutely. Oh, you know what? Also, the connection between rashes and antibiotics, there's a very specific one with mononucleosis. I just want you to talk about for a minute, please.
Sure. If you prescribe amoxicillin for somebody with mononucleosis, what are the odds? Somewhere around 90% that they're going to break out in a morbilliform rash or measles-looking rash?
Which is not hive-like, but again, people may not know that difference.
Right.
It's more of a very fine kind of a rash.
Right, exactly.
And a little flatter.
It's almost diagnostic.
Right, except you might think it's an allergic reaction to the antibiotic, which is why I brought that up.
Right.
When are hives more serious? I mean, we're talking about, you know, mostly for the most part, just a kind of a bumpy rash that's itchy and annoying, and you can give an antihistamine, but we're not talking about other associated symptoms, except the ones we talked about with the swelling of the joints and the mucous membranes, like that already is more serious. What other types of hives would you say are more serious?
If they're painful, if they leave a bruise, those can be signs of vasculitis, which is much more serious, and you might need a biopsy for that. Hives that are making the person uncomfortable, if they're interfering with your quality of life, it really is time to get assistance. Everybody's worried that it might progress to an anaphylactic reaction with throat closing or trouble breathing. That's not likely to occur at all.
Mm-hmm. But obviously when it does, that's an emergency.
Right, but that's...
911, give your EpiPen if you have it.
That'll happen right away, and that'll be in association with other symptoms. But if we're talking about just skin alone, hives, again, usually doesn't progress to anything else.
Right. I'm also thinking of something called cold urticaria.
Mm-hmm. So there are many different triggers for hives, and there's some physical stimuli. Some people will respond to heat, some people will respond to cold. But particularly in association with viral illnesses, some kids and some adults will break out in hives when they're exposed to changes in weather. So they go out in the cold, they'll start breaking out, and that can be particularly serious when they go swimming.
Mm-hmm. So what happens?
You can get all the blood rushing to your skin, and theoretically you can pass out. That's a rare occurrence, but that could be quite severe. So you want to treat that aggressively with antihistamines before going out in the cold. And, you know, for instance, if you're a kid and you're going swimming, you don't want to be jumping into a light cold lake. You want to just be easing in gradually like the older folks do.
Right. You know, we have had patients with cold urticaria, and it is possible to go into anaphylaxis from jumping in the water.
Yes, it is.
Right. So how would you prevent that? Besides, you say going in slowly.
Education and getting it under control. So there are some really good medications for treating all different types of hives. If antihistamines aren't working, we have a biologic agent called Xolair, which is very effective in severe cases as well. It's given by injection once a month.
Is that covered by insurance?
It is if it's indicated.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Okay, so mastocytosis, what is that?
Well, mastocytosis, is part of a group of disorders that fall into the category of mast cell activation syndrome. Mast cells are these immune cells that live in our connective tissue, like the skin, gut, and the lung, and they release chemicals like histamine that are involved in immune responses. There's a bunch of different subcategories, but systemic mastocytosis, you can get release of all these chemicals either spontaneously or in response to allergic triggers, like insect stings that can put the patient's life at risk.
I'm thinking also of those mastocytomas. Those are pretty common to have a single lesion on your body. I don't know if you want to talk about what a single mastocytoma is and what happens when you have multiple ones.
Called urticaria pigmentosa, which are brownish kind of freckly looking lesions. And the real characteristic there is when you stroke them, they will expand and become hive-like. Again, that's something that can be readily diagnosed by an experienced dermatologist or allergist, and it's common in children.
And they usually just get diagnoses too, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. If you've seen it and you know what you're looking for.
Right. And even for a parent to see, oh, my child has this like freckle-like lesion and every once in a while it looks like a hive. It's not uncommon to have one of them. I don't think that that's called urticaria pigmentosum. I think it's just called the mastocytoma. I think that's way more common than someone who has a collection of them. But when someone has a collection of them, you know, that's a risk for anaphylaxis, correct? Because all of the ones could be activated at the same time. I need your help here. This is what I don't know about.
Yeah, no, that's correct. Again, not my area of expertise, but
okay, fair.
Yeah, distinct disorder.
Yeah, so important to know about. Okay, let's go on to seasonal and other environmental allergies, which is a huge topic. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, well, let's go. Let's start with just basic treatments for seasonal allergies, because I mean, obviously you can do testing, but a lot of people are even quite aware of their triggers.
Right, most people self-medicate. So if you have sneezing, congestion, itchy eyes, and you know, predominantly in the spring when you're around pets, you can use over-the-counter medicines, ideally before symptoms start. So the non-drowsy antihistamines that we've mentioned previously are very effective. The nasal sprays are even more effective. So the corticosteroid-based nose sprays like fluticasone or the antihistamine type nose sprays like azelastines are the ones you want to use. You want to stay away from decongestant nose sprays like Afrin, which can cause what we call rebound congestion if you use them regularly.
Right. And also I want to point out that you should take that Flonase before the season even starts.
Yep. And you want to use it regularly.
Right. Because I think a lot of people think they can use it as needed.
It does have some effectiveness that way, but that's not the best way to take it.
Right, right. By the way, what about, there's another form of cetirizine, levocetirizine, which is also known in the generic name as
brand name is Zizol.
Zizol. What do you think about that versus just regular Zyrtec? Just curious.
It's fine. Good medication as well.
Do you think there's a benefit to it, a significant benefit?
Levocetirizine is a metabolite of cetirizine. So, you know, nobody does real head-to-head studies to decide which is better. So whichever one works for the individual patient is fine.
That makes sense, you know, because I think people swear by Allegra and other people don't respond to it. So I think it makes sense to use what works for you. It was marketed, though, as to have less side effect in some way. And I don't remember what that side effect was.
Probably less drowsiness, but
less drowsiness. But Zyrtec is supposed to be a non-drowsy. That's why I'm so confused.
It's low sedating. So, you know, everybody responds differently to medication. Fexofenadine, in my opinion, is the true non-drowsy, where it's very unlikely you're going to get any sedative effects with it. I would say probably 10 to 15% of the population does get some sedative effects with cetirizine or even levocetirizine. So you have to know how it affects you or your child.
Interesting. It's so individualized. It's so true.
But they're very effective.
Okay. What about people who are not responding to any of this?
Then I think it's probably time to see a doctor, get some more medical advice. In terms of options, you want to make sure you're using your medications correctly. You want to make sure you have the diagnosis right, because some people who have chronic nasal congestion or runny nose may not even have allergic rhinitis. There's something called non-allergic rhinitis, which responds a little bit differently. Sometimes you can have, you know, a chronic sinus infection or anatomic obstructions, such as enlarged adenoids. That affect your ability to breathe through your nose. And then you have, if it's just plain old allergies and you're not responding well to medication, you have the option of allergy shots, which is still a really effective treatment. They've been around for over 100 years. They work for the right patient who takes the time to go through it.
Right. What about other forms of desensitization? Aren't there, it's like an oral form?
There are sublingual tablets that are approved for the FDA by the FDA for certain pollens like grass, ragweed, and dust mites. Again, in terms of head-to-head studies, most of us still are not convinced that they work better than conventional immunotherapy, and it's difficult to use in combination. Some doctors make up their own concoction of sublingual drops, which have been effective in some cases, but again, not FDA approved, and most of us still like the conventional allergy immunotherapy if you have the time to go through it.
Makes sense.
Or the shots, yeah.
So speaking of desensitization, let's talk about peanut allergy. I think there's been a lot of changes with peanut allergy management and even prevention. We can go back to prevention.
Yeah, one of the most exciting things in my lifetime. Obviously we're seeing more and more patients with food allergies. Peanut allergy is the most common, particularly in young kids. I think Dr. Sadia pointed out that the data is showing that if you introduce peanut early, you are less likely to become allergic. And as a secondary measure, if you do have a child who breaks out or has a reaction to peanut, there's other options besides just saying, totally avoid it and just carry an EpiPen. We're doing something called oral immunotherapy or desensitization. It's not the standard of care. It's a minority of practices that are doing it, but I think it's becoming more and more common. So instead of complete avoidance for the right patient and the right family, we can give tiny amounts of the food. In this case, it would be peanut. You take it every day. You gradually increase the amount over time under a doctor's supervision. And a lot of kids can be able to tolerate peanut. It's an absolute change in quality of life. It's fantastic. It's clearly not for everybody, but for the right patient and family, it's life-changing.
Right. I mean, it's incredible how stressful it is because you never know when there's going to be an exposure.
That's right.
So it can be a really serious allergy and really, really scary for parents. So that's amazing. But do you have to take it on a daily basis so you don't become allergic again?
You do. So the whole idea is you're developing a tolerance. In some cases, you're extinguishing the allergy, but you're basically getting your body used to it. So you want to keep it in your system. Again, very small amounts, gradually increases over time. There are risks of allergic reactions along the way. But most people would take the line, look, I'd rather have an allergic reaction at home or in a doctor's office than out in a restaurant or the playground.
Absolutely. And there's an obvious segue to preventing it also by introducing it early. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between higher risk and lower risk babies in terms of peanut introduction?
Sure. So if you're getting a sense that the infant already has some allergies, either because they have eczema or they've had problems with breastfeeding or formula intolerances, or they have a high family history of allergies, such as siblings who might have food allergies, that's a child at higher risk. So there's a couple of options there. You could just say, all right, I'm going to introduce peanut at home. I'll have a little bit of an antihistamine or something available to treat an allergic reaction. Or if you're risk averse, you can go to an allergist and get an allergy test done first. If the skin test is negative, that has pretty high predictive value and you're safe introducing it at home. If you have a positive test that's where some allergists have diverse opinions on how to handle that. So depending on the results of a skin test or blood test, some allergists would tell the parent, look, we're going to avoid peanut. We're going to look at the skin tests and blood tests again when your child is older. I'm of the opinion that if you have a positive test and we haven't introduced peanut yet, I'm going to have them come into the office and try it in my office because you don't know what's going to happen. So sometimes that child will be able to tolerate peanut and be fine. Sometimes the child will have a little bit of peanut. Let's say we try Bomba or a little bit of peanut butter and just breaks out in a bit of a rash. And that's the time to introduce the concept of oral immunotherapy. It's okay, let's just keep going. We'll keep giving that, you know, half a piece of Bomba every day. And every week or two, we're going to increase it. And over time, that child's going to be having peanut regularly. And that's a great window of opportunity because the very young children seem to be able to be more malleable in terms of their immune systems and more likely to respond to this very well.
Right. This is a huge sea change from thinking that we should wait. I remember, you know, earlier in my career as a pediatrician, we would wait for years to start these hyperallergenic type foods. And we were so wrong. And I worked at a practice. I worked at a practice with a pediatrician who was very foresightful. And he used to say, Bomba in Israel, they give it. We should be giving peanuts products earlier. He was saying that before the studies even came out. And he was absolutely right. So it's this intuition that we should hold off on something was completely backwards. What age do you start this at?
So again, somewhere between 6 to 12 months is the time when we recommend introducing peanut. And you know, again, if you fail the initial response, depending on your reaction, you know, if a child had an anaphylactic reaction, I would not propose starting oral immunotherapy that young unless the parent was really motivated. Right. Might wait till they're a little bit older. But again, if they just broke out in a bit of a rash, that's a great opportunity to keep introducing it, in my personal opinion.
Right, but how do you know that the second time they won't have a worse reaction?
Usually the same amount of food will provoke a similar reaction. So again, we're giving it in the office. Let's say they had, you know, a couple of pieces of Bomba, they broke out in a rash. I might instruct the parent, all right, tomorrow just give half a piece of Bomba, a quarter of that dose. Let's do that every day for a week. Come back to the office next week. Let's give them a whole piece and we'll gradually go up from there.
So back to thinking about the high-risk patients, I'm a little confused because I was told that if you have a family history of peanut allergy, you're not really at significantly higher risk in terms of behaving differently in terms of introduction of peanut products, like testing first. My question is, who should be tested first before being given the peanut products?
Right. Confusing. Because in general, you don't inherit a specific allergy. You inherit a tendency, a genetic predisposition towards developing allergy. But there's at least one study that I was aware of that showed that siblings of children with peanut allergy seem to be at somewhat higher risk of developing peanut allergy. And again, look at the whole atopic history. If the parents, you know, both have allergic disorders, the child has, you know, pretty severe eczema, that's a higher risk kid.
Egg allergy, I heard. I mean, there's guidelines for this. I'm pretty sure it's egg allergy and eczema, but not a family history of peanut allergy in terms of testing early.
That's, you know, you may be right. But again, I look at the whole gestalt and the whole picture, and it's not a hard line. It's you just talk to the parents and say, what are you comfortable with? It's if they're comfortable introducing it at home, I'm okay with that. If they would rather get tested first, I'm okay with that as well.
But that is fantastic. That is a fantastic approach.
One of the things to realize is that death from anaphylaxis in infants, I don't think has been reported from food allergy. So that may be somewhat reassuring. It's absolutely terrifying when you have a child with an allergic reaction at home. Right. But again, chances are really good it's going to be a controlled situation.
Right. There are some parents that are just so afraid of introducing peanuts. They say, can I come to your office and give my child that the first time? Not even a risk factors, just they're just scared.
What do you do in that case?
Do we do that?
Yeah.
It hasn't come up in a long time. I don't remember what I did in that particular case. I think sometimes it's really more about anxiety. I think we've created a lot of anxiety about allergic reactions in food by focusing on it. We have awareness, but we also have anxiety.
I think it's really important to put those risks in perspective. Mm-hmm. When you hear about tragic cases of deaths from food allergy, that sticks in your mind, right, and that's normal, but you have to realize how really uncommon that is. So I kind of love to put things in perspective, and I tell parents, look, the most dangerous thing your child's going to do is drive in a car with you. You just did that.
Office,
you
didn't think, right.
Yeah.
More risk to drive to the office for your allergy challenge.
Right. You didn't think about that, but you put your kid in a car seat. You went with a safe driver, but you can't control if somebody comes barreling at you 100 miles an hour. And, you know, anaphylactic reactions are scary, but most of the time they resolve quite well, even without medication. But that goes back to the point of you don't want to leave things to chance. If you have a life-threatening food allergy, you want to be carrying an epinephrine injector and you want to use it aggressively.
Right. Do you recommend that when a child does get their EpiPen for an allergic reaction that they call 911 and go to the hospital?
Great question. One of the things we love to do is go over education. We have to go over it again and again and again. It's like, I tell people, it's kind of like a fire drill. You don't want to panic. You want to know what to do. So if you have a significant allergic reaction of any sort, the epinephrine injector is the antidote. It'll shut off the reaction quickly. It'll make you or your child feel better, and it'll make it far less likely that it's going to go into a life-threatening situation. So I don't want people to call the office. I don't want them to go to urgent care. I don't want them to go to the ER. If they have bad hives, abdominal pain, difficulty breathing, the constellation of symptoms, I want them to go ahead and use the epinephrine injector. And then during the pandemic, there was a new guideline suggestion that you don't automatically have to go to the emergency room. Not all doctors agree with this, but for the right patient, if you have a responsible adult there, I suggest that they wait. Take 10 or 15 minutes and reassess the situation.
I think this is really helpful. I'm sorry, before I forget, I think this is really helpful, because I'll tell you what happens is people are afraid to use the EpiPen because they don't want to have to go to the hospital.
Exactly. And that's why they changed that advice. And most of the time you go to the emergency room, they're not even using epinephrine when they should. And a lot of times you just spend a lot of time just sitting around being observed. So if it's important to just kind of realize that after you use epinephrine, it's not dangerous. There's a lot of myths about it. You're going to feel a little shaky or jittery, like you've had a really strong cup of coffee. That's going to wear off. You want to get the person to lie down, because you want to get the blood flowing to their head, and you don't want them passing out or going into shock or anything like that. Wait a few minutes and see how they feel. Very often, if it's a young child, they're up and running around playing, and they're acting like they're back to normal. The adult is going to be feeling a whole lot better sooner. And if that's the case, you can observe in place. If you do not like the way they look, it's a judgment call. You call 911 and go.
Right. And again, this does not constitute medical advice here.
This is very controversial among doctors.
Talk with your physician.
This is my practice, but a lot of allergists would absolutely not agree with this.
Right. But what I like about it is you're trying to motivate the family to use the EpiPen at the drop of a hat, because the risk of not using it is greater than the risk of using it.
Absolutely.
And I want to talk just for a minute about antihistamine, because I feel like also people have, I don't like having antihistamines in the allergy action plan for schools. And if you want to talk a minute about allergy action plan for schools, the reason I don't is I don't want anybody sitting around going, I'm going to give Benadryl and wait.
I hear that. That's an interesting perspective on it. I do want responsible medical professionals to have options. So mm-hmm. for instance, if a child shows up in the nurse's office and just has hives, I want them to have the option of giving the antihistamine if it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. But I do want them to be real aggressive with the epinephrine. If it's severe hives, or again, some people will show up with just really bad abdominal pain, or start coughing, sneezing, runny nose. If things are happening fast,
right,
the person's looking uncomfortable, don't wait. Absolutely use that epinephrine injector. And in schools, the protocol is going to be call 911.
Right. Because the reason I'm saying is I'm talking about an allergy action plan. I'm not talking about a medication administration list for school. Those are two different things. It wouldn't mm-hmm. keep a child from getting, an antihistamine in school for other reasons. It's just in the case of an exposure to an allergen that the child has, a severe allergy to. I don't want anybody wasting a minute deciding, should I first try the antihistamine? Should I watch the child for a while? And it can be so confusing whether they're going into anaphylaxis, because like you said, they may be vomiting. It may not look like what you think anaphylaxis should be. I don't know if you want to talk about that a little more.
No, that's an excellent point. So an antihistamine is not going to stop somebody from going into anaphylaxis. It's just, it takes a long time to kick in, and the symptoms may be going away on their own. But anaphylaxis, it's easy to pick up when somebody's breaking out in hives, coughing, sneezing, having trouble breathing. It can be more subtle than that. All of a sudden, the kid may not look right. They may be looking pale. They may not be feeling well. They may be holding their stomach. They may be going to the bathroom with sudden onset of explosive diarrhea or cramps. And they may just pass out. So if you have a food allergic child, with any symptoms that aren't looking right, I totally agree with you. Use epinephrine first.
Right. When in doubt, just give
it. No harm done.
Yeah. When in doubt, just give it. And that's why I like the opportunity, the option of not going to the emergency room. And again, this depends on your physician. This depends on your allergist. It's so individualized, and we're not providing medical advice here. We're just kind of updating everybody on what the current information is. I think about it like, for example, with a child who has seizures. So a child who has a first seizure is in general going to go to the hospital, but a child who has a seizure disorder who has a recurrence of their seizure doesn't necessarily need to. So if the automatic protocol is you have a seizure, you have to go to the hospital, and this child is having recurrent seizures, that's often not necessary.
I like that analogy. Yeah.
Right. And so that's how I think a child who has a reaction who had to use their EpiPen. We don't want to limit the use of their EpiPen. And like you said, they're probably going to be completely fine, especially when you know what the trigger is, you know they have an allergy, that's what they do, they take the EpiPen. So I like that option of it not having it be automatic, which is still automatic on my allergy action plans, by the way.
Absolutely, and you have to know your circumstances and you have to know yourself. If you're just gonna panic at home, just go ahead and call 911. If you're not in a good, safe situation, it's not the time to do that. But if you happen to be at home and you've been through this, you know what you're doing, it's okay to wait a few minutes. That few minutes may buy you enough time to realize, okay, my kid or I am stable. I can get through this.
Right. And please call us, the pediatrician, so we know what's going on.
I do want to make one caveat there. If you're thinking that things are bad enough for me to call a doctor or go to urgent care, use the epinephrine injector. I totally agree with that, but I don't like it when people call me and say, all right, I'm coughing, I'm having trouble breathing, what should I do now? It's like,
I think we can say it one more time for the people in the back. Use your EpiPen.
Use your EpiPen if you're in doubt. I mean, there's so many myths about this that it's going to precipitate a heart attack or an arrhythmia or anything like that. There's no contraindications.
Right. Or that you should use an antihistamine first. We're saying it over and over again because it's an important point. And I think both you and I see that in patients, and it frustrates us because we have a life-saving medication that's very low risk. That's the reason we put it in the hands of families who have children with these kind of allergies, which are unfortunately common.
And how many times have you seen people go to the emergency room or urgent care and get steroids or Pepcid or Benadryl when they need epinephrine?
Right. Or all that with it, but.
Right.
Okay. We talked about that already. Go over that again. So allergies and eczema, let's talk about that for a few minutes. We talked a little bit about how you could have eczema and that could be a sign of a food allergy. Is it always a sign of a food allergy?
No. So eczema is one of those allergic or atopic conditions. And I make the analogy with asthma. So there's chronic inflammation of the skin that can come and go, and there may be certain triggers involved with that. And in some cases, there's a food allergy. In many cases, there is not. And the problem with eczema is that infants and children in particular have sky-high IgE or allergic antibody levels. So if you do allergy testing, you may get lots of positive tests that have nothing to do with the eczema at all.
Right, this is probably what happened to my child that I mentioned before that was allergic to everything in the world, supposedly.
Right. So, again, let's say you have a breastfeeding infant, 6 months old, really severe uncontrolled eczema. It may be very helpful to do the most common foods. And let's say you get a positive test for egg. Mom takes egg out of her diet, skin clears up. I think we've all seen that. On the other hand, when you, as the child gets older and older, it's less likely that you're going to find, you know, a food to eliminate that's going to just totally change the eczema. The way you treat the eczema is with good skincare, you know, moisturizers, topical anti-inflammatories like steroids. And then if it's severe uncontrolled eczema, then I think there is a role to look for allergies.
Does it matter whether you do skin tests or blood tests?
I think it matters how you interpret the tests. Mm-hmm. So if there's a clear area to do skin on the, to do skin testing on the back, I prefer to do skin testing because I think there's less false positives. But sometimes, you know, you'll have to put those two pieces of information together. But it really is important in how you interpret it. Mm-hmm. And for instance, if you get positive tests, do a diagnostic trial elimination. So take the food out of the diet for a couple of weeks and then put it back. But I think you're doing this kid a disservice if you take foods out of the diet for extended periods of time without proof that they're really causing the eczema.
Right. Especially if you're just basing it on allergy testing alone.
Right.
Which is why I have a preference of sending to an allergist as opposed to doing the testing myself at that point. I don't. I mean, I know different people do different things, but I try not to do allergy testing because at the end of the day, I'm going to have to figure out what to do with the results.
Right.
And there's so many false positives. And again, we talked about it more in the talk with Dr. Zadia. You know, I'm not going to go into detail here, but there's a very high false positive rate with both.
Exactly.
So that the bottom line, my understanding is the gold standard is whether they tolerate it without a reaction or not.
Right, exactly. Right. There are certain cross-reactive foods. So if I have a young child who's allergic to peanut, I'll check for tree nuts and mm-hmm. sesame if they haven't had them. But sometimes, you know, a well-meaning doctor can order, you know, milk and egg and, right. and fish and things like that the kid is eating. And it makes absolutely no sense to test for those foods.
Right. They've already tolerated it.
Exactly.
Right. So that's really, really important. So let's go talk a little bit about asthma. We're going to really just focus on the older kids. And I really just want you to give us a little bit of an update on some newer treatments that we have.
So let's go back. Asthma is a really common disorder manifested by coughing, wheezing, shortness of breath, and it's different things for different people. So you may see adults who are out of breath all the time unless they take their medication, and you may see kids who are absolutely fine in between episodes, but when they get a cold, they get really bad cough that lingers for weeks, or they may go into respiratory distress and wind up in the emergency room. And, you know, it's important to realize that, you know, all of those things can be asthma. The underlying problem is airway inflammation. And there's two types of medicines that we use to treat asthma. There's the bronchodilators, most commonly albuterol, that make symptoms go away right away. And there's anti-inflammatory medications, which are inhaled corticosteroids like Flovent, Qvar, Asmanex. Those are the common names. From a patient perspective, though, the most important medicines are the anti-inflammatory medicines, but they don't make them feel better. The bronchodilators make them feel better, but those are the ones we as doctors don't want them taking regularly because they don't change or modify the disorder. They don't decrease the risk of exacerbations.
That's really helpful. And I'm glad that you mentioned that not everybody is presenting as I have asthma. Right? They may be presenting as I have a cough. And my pet peeve as a pediatrician is kids who've been treated for asthma who come in and say, I've got a cough medicine that I use when I get a cough, and it's albuterol.
Right.
And they have no asthma diagnosis. So my first thing is get the diagnosis. I don't know why there's a stigma against it.
Right. I think that people are still used to the idea that, you know, might affect your ability to do sports. It might label the child or stigmatize the kid. I think it is, I agree with you 100%. It's so important to have the diagnosis so that you know what you're dealing with. And if you go to another doctor's office or an urgent care center, you're not being treated with cough medicines or antibiotics. You're being treated with the right medicine.
Oh my gosh, antibiotics. They get misdiagnosed with pneumonia all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that is really, really important. So that's what I tell parents. I say, I want to use the word asthma. And how would you say you would define asthma? You talked about it a little bit, but can you give a short, this is what asthma is.
Chronic inflammatory disease of the airways mm-hmm. That can go through periods of remission and exacerbation, responds to bronchodilators, and usually manifested by coughing, wheezing, or shortness of breath.
What I tell them is it's reversible constriction of the little airways in the lungs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Reversible. So if you're using asthma and you feel better, I'm going to call it asthma. Using albuterol, sorry, I'm going to call it asthma. And I tell them that, you know, you can outgrow asthma, correct?
Correct. Sometimes. But sometimes they just wind up outgrowing their pediatricians.
Right. Also, they may be getting triggers from cold to not get colds as frequently as they get older.
Right. So just to tell you a little, you know, vignette or story, I see adults as well as kids. So very often I'll see patients come in and they've got recurrent episodes of bronchitis. They're getting coughing episodes. Nothing's responding. And then you do a pulmonary function test. You treat them with asthma medication and they're getting better. And you ask them, did you ever have a problem like this when you were younger? Oh, yeah, when I was a kid, I used a nebulizer. I had wheezy bronchitis, you know, whatever terms they were going to use. But they had asthma. And it's not uncommon, at least during the adolescent years, to go into periods of remission. Mm. And as an adult, you get a viral respiratory infection and it starts all over again. Mm. So it's possible to go away. It's also possible to go into long extending periods where you have no symptoms, but it can come back.
Right. And I think it's helpful. I do send to allergists when the parents are questioning the diagnosis, because you mentioned before you can do pulmonary function tests. At what age can you do that?
You know, the standards start at age 6, but sometimes you can get a cooperative 5 or 4 year old to do the test. Mm. It's really a fun computer game where you blow out into the computer as hard as you can, and you can measure airway obstruction. And you can see if they improve when they get a bronchodilator, and it's a diagnostic test. But very frequently, you know what you're dealing with by the response to medication.
Right, absolutely. So that's really helpful. Let's talk about steroids, because you mentioned that it's not simply the constriction of the airway that the albuterol opens up, which is what they sense, which is why they're happy to take it, but it's the inflammatory changes in the airways. I just usually call that swelling of the airways. I draw a picture with a swollen airway. The importance of the steroid, because I also see a lot of steroid phobia.
Right. So, you know, again, on the spectrum of how we've been treating asthma, I think you and I both learned that when you start out, you start using albuterol. If they're using albuterol frequently, you start using prophylactic medications. And now we're learning that that's not necessarily the way to go. There's a concept in asthma treatment now called SMART therapy, which stands for single inhaler as for maintenance and reliever therapy. So you can combine a bronchodilator medication with an inhaled steroid and let the patient use it on an as-needed basis or regular basis, depending on what they need. There are a couple of medications on the market that fulfill the criteria. They're fast-acting bronchodilators. They're as effective as albuterol, but they're also long-acting. And those medications go under the brand name of Symbicort and Dulera. There's a generic version of Symbicort available. There's more products that are going to be coming on the market. And a lot of us are using this as first-line therapy for the older kids and adults.
How old?
5 and up.
5 and up, because it was till 12 and up not that long ago.
Right.
That's a huge change.
Yeah.
Are the insurance covering them more?
Hopefully they're getting there, but that can be a problem.
And but that's only one, you said only two, right? Symbicort and Dulera, I think?
Budesonide is the one in Symbicort, and Mometasone is the one in Dulera. Okay. That's the inhaled steroid component.
But those are the only two that are approved for under 12, right?
Right. Again, there are guidelines that suggest that that can be used. Not all doctors follow that therapy, but I think it's fantastic because no longer do patients have to think about which inhaler, when, and it gets so confusing.
You want
me to use the inhaler that doesn't make me feel better? Why would I do that?
Right. It gets the steroid in there, by the way, because that is, for some reason, a hard sell. I mean, I think it's the hard sell of preventative medicine. Right? Taking something when you feel okay, do you still feel okay?
Right.
And that's a pet peeve of mine also, that people will, you know, children will be getting, or patients will be getting courses of oral steroids. And if you want to talk a minute about the difference between an oral steroid and an inhaled steroid.
So steroids are the best treatment for real severe asthma exacerbation. They take hours to kick in, but they really calm down the inflammation, the coughing, the wheezing, and can prevent you from having to go to the emergency room or acute care setting. And they also are the standard of treatment if you do wind up in the emergency room. And that's different than anaphylaxis. You definitely will get steroids if you go in for an asthma exacerbation. But the whole idea is to prevent that.
Right. What I was thinking of that when you take steroids for an acute exacerbation, you take it by mouth, or sometimes they'll even do an injection. They're doing more and more of the one dose dexamethasone instead of the prednisone, which is very practical and great, by the way, to be able to get one dose because that prednisone stuff is nasty.
Yep.
But what I try to explain to patients who I want to have them on a regular inhaled steroid to prevent an exacerbation is the amount of steroid you're getting with oral steroids or injectable steroids is way higher than the dose you're getting day after day after day with the inhaled. And if you want to elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think Dr. Critch pointed that out so excellently, that you're talking minuscule amounts. It's equivalent of using a cortisone cream on a rash compared to taking something systemically.
Right.
And if you compare the dose of low dose inhaled steroids taken every day all year round to a single course of oral steroids, you're getting more steroid with the 5 day course of steroids. So there, you know, there's nothing in medicine that's completely risk free. But we've been using inhaled steroids in patients, particularly even in children, for 60 years. There's not a whole population of short adults running around. The effects on growth are, in my opinion, negligible. You know, if you follow growth over time, nobody's going to wind up on inhaled steroids throughout their entire childhood. It usually does not affect growth. However, even if it does, it's far better than the alternative of not being able to breathe, not being able to participate in sports, other things. But when you talk about steroid phobia, it's important to communicate and hear what patients are actually concerned about, because that may mean different things to them. You have to validate their concerns.
Right, you can't
just dismiss them. You have to tell them, well, you know, this is realistic. But again, life is not about being risk-free. It's about risk-benefit, as you pointed out so importantly.
Right. No, I like that you say validate their fear, because, you know, people hear stuff in the news. It may not be a specific fear of, say, height, you know, having a shorter height. It may just be, ooh, steroids on a regular basis. That's, you know, that's really scary. And just explaining that the amount of steroid is way less over a whole year of inhaled versus one course of oral, I think helps most of the time.
Some people confuse them with the anabolic steroids, which are totally different.
Exactly.
They're not going to increase muscle mass.
Exactly. It's revolutionized asthma. I mean, when I was training and in my early years, we had so many kids hospitalized. You don't, thank God, see that so much.
You do not. And you don't see steroid-dependent asthma because we have these new biologic agents that are so effective.
Exactly.
But I think it's really important to treat asthma aggressively, particularly in kids, because if you have a kid who's missing school or, you know, learns that they can't keep up with their friends in sports, they fall behind. They stop playing sports. So it's kind of like putting on glasses.
It's right.
You know, if you're treating them effectively, you're improving their quality of life dramatically. It's such a great change, and the medicines are so effective and so much better than what we've had in previous generations. I think there really has been very satisfying for my career to see this.
Right, and also in terms of activity level and even obesity, which we didn't talk about, getting oral steroids intermittently is more of a risk for that than staying uninhaled, and also just being able to be more active, like you said.
Yeah.
So I mean, it has so much impact.
It's really important to talk to kids as well, because if you ask them, you know, what happens when you run around, you know, what sports do you play? Oh, I play soccer, but I'm the goalie because when I run laps, I can't keep up or whatever. It's, you know, getting into those details. The parents may not be aware of it.
Right. I have one more question for you, and I know we got over and I really appreciate your time. Who should see an allergist, in your opinion? I know there's other people's with other opinions, but I want to know your opinion.
So they, you know, there are different ways that people will present. So if it's really affecting your quality of life, if you're really concerned about it, I think it's time to see an allergist. But I think it's important to have a really good relationship with your primary care doctor and talk to them. So I would reflect that question to you in terms of, you know, when do you think it's time? When do you wind up referring them?
Right. I refer when I want more help. I refer when I want more time too, by the way. And I always complain about this in my podcast that it's very hard today to be a primary care physician. We don't have a lot of time. For a while we had an asthma educator from your office come to our office. That was amazing. Amazing. Because some of this is just education and that takes time. Mm-hmm. So I do that. Also, if I had a child who I wasn't able to help, like a child who might need that Xolair, right, or a higher level treatment, I don't have experience with that. That's higher level. I would send to you.
I think it's a collaboration. Very often, mm-hmm. I wind up saying the same things as you might, but mm-hmm. they might hear it differently. Okay, the specialist is now saying that I should take the inhaled steroids and it's better for me. So now I have two doctors telling me this is the right thing to do. Maybe I'll do that. So that it kind of reinforces it, and there's a good feedback back and forth. But you know, I think those conversations come up. Sometimes the patient will ask, you know, their pediatrician or their internist, you know, I really think I need to see an allergist. And sometimes primary care doctors realize, okay, you know, there's a constellation of symptoms here. They have, you know, sneezing and stuffy nose frequently. They're having some problems with asthma. They're breaking out with hives. They've got a penicillin allergy that, you know, maybe they do, maybe they don't. There's a lot of issues here that maybe we should address. So there's not a right or wrong answer. I think some of it is patient driven, and some mm-hmm. of it is just, you know, the primary care doctor realizing, okay, I need help or a collaborative effort.
Right. I love collaboration, number one. Number two, I love the extra help and extra time. But number three, when a patient says, the parent says they want something, you really need to listen. Right. It doesn't matter if I feel like I can handle this, they are asking for it. Right. Right. And so I think that we need to listen to that. And I am very happy to make referrals when a parent comes in and says, I would like my child to see an allergist. And then we have the collaborative effort. It's not rocket science, really. Right.
Right.
So I think that that's a good way to look at it. Anything else you want to add? I really appreciate all your time.
No, I think it was really great having this conversation and realizing that we share the same perspective on most of these disorders. It's been great.
It really has been. And I want to thank you so, so much for doing this with me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun.
Excellent. That's what I want to hear. People say they've had fun all the time. And that's exactly what I want to hear. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.